The Stories We Tell.
This is a book about very personal things of mine in some ways, but only as a way to talk about these things we all deal with. You know, the stories you're given, the stories you make, the stories that feed you, the stories that poison you. You know, and the way we navigate these constellations, these roads.
That's Rebecca Solnit, talking about her latest book, The Faraway Nearby, and poetry as experience.
My work is what I would call experiential. I think that when a reader is reading it or listening to it, rather than mastering it and feeling as though, okay, I can write, let's say, a thesis on this, that the poem will find its way into the reader and there'll be this relationship of embodiment.
That's poet Martine Bellin. She reads from and tells us about her new collection, The Wayback Machine. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Human beings are storytellers at heart, whether they're the stories we tell around the figurative campfire or those that tell us who we are. Stories create the map by which we navigate our lives. Rebecca Solnit's extraordinary new book, The Faraway Nearby, ponders the stories that comfort us, enchain us, and that can free us. The Faraway Nearby weaves its narrative from discursive threads of memoir, history, and natural science. Empathy and imagination provide the warp and woof. Solnit's personal stories about her mother's decline from Alzheimer's, the author's brush with mortal illness, or rotting apricots open to vistas of larger stories about Arctic exploration, medicine and justice, and how society treats its outcasts. Rebecca Solnit is the author of numerous books, including A Paradise Built in Hell and A Field Guide to Getting Lost. She'll be out with a new book about New Orleans, Unfathomable City, in November. In 2010, Utney Reader magazine named Solnit as one of the, quote, 25 visionaries who are changing your world. Rebecca Solnit, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, The Faraway Nearby, I did not understand the title when I first started reading the book, which is not unexpected. It became very clear to me, kind of like a photograph that becomes clearer the more it lies in the developing fluid. How did it come to you?
You know, the book had a number of working titles, none of which was wonderful. And then this came to me. I knew it well as the title of a George O'Keeffe painting. And as I researched it, it turned out that's also how she signed her letters to the people she loved best when they were far away. And I've never borrowed a title before. I've always made them up from scratch. And so I struggled to find an analogy, a synonym for this beautiful phrase, and nothing was quite as good. So I figured, George O'Keeffe, you've given me a wonderful gift. I hope I'm using it well.
There are several themes in the book. I'm only going to pick up on a few of them here. That is connection and disconnection, the ripening of time and decay, and identity. And I felt that all these themes, as well as the others, were anchored in some sense by you making sense of your relationship with your mother and how that relationship changed as she went further down the road of Alzheimer's. At the end of the book, you say you call it the history of an emergency and the stories that kept you company then. I wonder if you could tell us a bit, just to start out, about your early relationship with your mother and how that turned you into a reader.
You know, I'm not sure that it turned me into a reader, but I was somebody, before I learned how to read, who was in love with stories. And as soon as I learned how to read, sort of dove into books, hid out in books, ran away to books. My mother was a reader as well. Both of my parents loved books. Maybe not as intensely as I did. But my mother was also somebody who was terribly burdened by stories, some very much her own, some the one society gives us about what our lives should include, what people should give us, what constitutes a good life, what it means to be a woman, what your daughter should give you. And, you know, and I say somewhere in the book that my great relationship with her precedes my memory and postdates her memory. I'm sure before it became a very fraught relationship. There, you know, the things a mother does for a child are you know, exhausting, endless, and amazing in those first few years, and she certainly did those for me. And then I took care of her a lot the last several years of her life, and she forgot those stories that had been the source of so many of our problems. And with that, her animosity and whatever was churning inside her kind of subsided, and she was at peace with herself and at peace with me. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about what you see this book being about. I have a slightly different list, and central to it is storytelling, what we make of our lives. You know, I've said elsewhere, the stars are given to us, the constellations we pick out. How do we pick constellations out of our lives of how lucky we are, how cursed we are, what our lives are supposed to be, what matters, what our purpose is? You know, and that changes as you as your life changes, as you grow up, as you remember, as you forget. And that was very much what this book was about. And it was important to me, too, because writers so often talk about stories in a purely celebratory fashion, as though, yeah, we all have stories. Aren't stories magical? Aren't they all wonderful gifts? And it's like, well, actually, some of them are curses and afflictions and prisons. And it's really important to look at, where do your stories come from? How conscious of them are you? What do you do with them? What do they do to you?
Yeah, and how the stories that other people have about their lives creates your own story, and one that you find the need to free yourself from at some point, and how difficult that is. That was something very much that I got from your book.
And I think that's true for so many of us, whether it's gay and lesbian kids being told, you know, that what they're supposed to grow up to be that doesn't fit, or people of color given white models, or, you know, and it's so normal for parents to have expectations of their kids, and all of us pick up from the ambient culture around us what our lives are supposed to include, and that doesn't necessarily work, or it might work, but it's not who we are and what we want. And so I think all of us have a struggle to figure out who we are and what story that makes, to make a story out of our lives. And so much of the work is not just making a story, but unmaking the stories that confine us, poison us, constrain us, that we're given. I think that's work all of us do. And this is a book about very personal things of mine in some ways, but only as a way to talk about these things we all deal with. You know, the stories you're given, the stories you make, the stories that feed you, the stories that poison you, you know, and the way we navigate these constellations, these roads, however you want to describe them.
At the end of the book, you recount the story of Jessica McClure, this 2-year-old who fell down a well, and the ways in which other people made her story their story and used her story to change their story. For example, Charlie Musselwhite, and also her rescuer, very disparate ways of relating to her story. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't even know how that story came back to me. I sort of remembered it. Oh, actually, I do. That I actually heard Charlie Musselwhite on the radio talking, and he's this wonderful blues singer, harmonica player, vocalist who's been around a really long time. And he talked about how, I forget what year it was. You've probably looked at that part of the book more recently than me, 87 or something.
It was.
A 2-year-old in Texas. You know, the phone rang. Her mother went indoors for a moment, and somebody had moved the cover of an old well in the backyard. She fell down this very narrow shaft in bedrock and became trapped about 20 feet below the ground. A massive rescue effort was mounted to get her out, and it was this great, you know, not that I think it's wonderful it happened, but it's, you know, it's great fodder for the news. So there's, and it was really the beginning of cable news 24/7 coverage. The media swarmed. It was a huge story, and Charlie Musselwhite heard about it on the radio, and he was somebody who drank quite heavily. And he was so moved by this little girl who was being brave and was singing as she was trapped underground and hanging in there, that he vowed that he wouldn't have another drink till she was out, as this way, you know, and in a magical way of kind of committing to her, giving her his support. And of course, it worked for him. It says a lot about who he was, that his first thought was, I won't drink until she's out. That, you know, but he made out of her story an occasion to get himself out of the well he was trapped in, because he'd had a, you know, his life had been, it sounds like, a mess. He had drank way too much. And he never had another drink. And so he told that story many years later. And then, of course, so many people would say, like, you know, what was wonderful about the story. But then the slender firefighter who was sent down the parallel shaft headfirst to rescue her had a really traumatic experience from the same incident, the claustrophobia, the media attention afterwards that didn't give him room to be traumatized or to be himself. Just so overwhelmed him, he resorted to drugs to kind of soften his pain and eventually shot himself. And then the philosopher Peter Singer took the story as an example of human behavior he disapproved of. He thought rather than irrationally donating lots of money to a little girl who maybe didn't need it, we should rationally distribute our money to children in need. And so that's a third story. And you can see all these stories arising from an incident that doesn't necessarily mean any of those things, that people are making stories out of something, you know, and the rescuer who shot himself, it seems as though it was the stories people made about him fit him so badly, gave him so little room for who he was and what he needed and to tell his own story that it killed him in a sense. And then Jessica McClure grew up, collected the million-plus dollars that had been donated, went to college, married, had children. She's still in her 20s, I think. She had a very quiet life and stayed out of the limelight. You know, so those are four life stories springing from this incident, and none of which we know completely, but all of which are so different. Peter Singer isn't a life story, but who he is so clear and the kind of hyper-rationalism he brings to the idea of kindness and support.
Right. We each make the meaning of the stories that we hear to fit our own stories. And as you point out in your book, our own stories also change. You have a lovely phrase that I wrote down. You say books, and I would say here we can also say stories, are solitudes in which we meet.
Yeah, for me, books in particular, because often stories are told face-to-face and there's a deep, there's eye contact, you're physically present. But books so often we read in solitude. And it's a really interesting thing being a writer. You know, I've been publishing books for more than 20 years now and, you know, magazine pieces and things longer. And in the first several years, I heard very little from anybody about what I was doing. And now people get back to me, and I know people have done interesting things with my books. They're assigned in universities. People have found things that are helpful in them and quoted them in their own books, etc. But mostly you don't know. Mostly they're messages in bottles. You don't know if they ever land on shore, if they're ever opened, and what they mean when they're opened. And I think that's something curious because they're both so personal and in one way and so disconnected in another. And because of the distantness of reading and writing compared to oral culture, which is what human beings had for hundreds of thousands of years before reading and writing as we now know them, you know, even earlier versions of reading and writing were often more communal. They say that 2,000 years ago, people, you know, didn't read silently. You read aloud often to other people. Even in Dickens' times, you know, families gathered together and read books like his aloud. Whereas now almost all our reading is silent and alone, just as writing is almost all silent and alone. So books are solitudes in which we meet. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get reports back from people who've met you there.
And this might be a good moment, actually, to ask you to read the first page and the sentence that completes on the second page of your book. Would you be willing to do that?
Of course. My pleasure. What's your story? It's all in the telling. Stories are compasses in architecture. We navigate by them. We build our sanctuaries and our prisons out of them. And to be without a story is to be lost in the vastness of a world that spreads in all directions like Arctic tundra or sea ice. To love someone is to put yourself in their place, we say, which is to put yourself in their story or figure out how to tell yourself their story, which means that a place is a story and stories are geography. And empathy is first of all an act of imagination, a storyteller's art, and then a way of traveling from here to there. What is it like to be the old man silenced by a stroke, the young man facing the executioner, the woman walking across the border, the child on the roller coaster, the person you've only read about, or the one next to you in bed. We tell ourselves stories in order to live or to justify taking lives, even our own, by violence or by numbness and the failure to live. Tell ourselves stories that save us and stories that are the quicksand in which we thrash and the well in which we drown. Stories of justification, of accursedness, of luck and star-crossed love, or versions clad in the cynicism that is at times a very elegant garment. Sometimes the story collapses and it demands that we recognize we've been lost, or terrible, or ridiculous, or just stuck. Sometimes change arrives like an ambulance or a supply drop. Not a few stories are sinking ships, and many of us go down with these ships, even when the lifeboats are bobbing all around us.
Yeah, it's beautiful, as so much of what you write, Rebecca Solnit, in this book, The Faraway Nearby. So back to your mom. I don't know whether I am so interested in the story because I recently lost my mother, who was also a very difficult person, a very wonderful person in many ways, but very tough on her daughter, me, her only child, and who didn't have Alzheimer's but did have some dementia toward the end of her life that made her, if anything, more difficult, not less. So I was very interested in how you worked through the process of the change in your relationship to your mother as she went down the road of Alzheimer's.
Well, at first, you know, she became more erratic and more needy, and enormous demands were made on me and my brothers. I have two brothers who were really fantastic co-caregivers and were really wonderful all the way through. But she would call me, and because my relationship with her was just so much more damaged, you know, meant something really different for me to become her caregiver. And, you know, and in a sense, I'd known she'd been demanding I be her caregiver most of my life, that this was coming. And it was incredibly stressful because, you know, it's like raising a child only backwards. Things are not getting better. You didn't sign up for it. And unlike a parent, nobody thinks you're in control, including the person you're taking care of. And, you know, you don't even have legal rights of control, let alone, you know, the consent of the person you're trying to help. Mm-hmm. So there was that. But it was also really interesting because suddenly at a certain turn in the road, and I don't know if it was the progression of the disease or the medication I had to put her on at that point, she just forgot all her stories about me. And it was really interesting to me how much her kind of rage at me had been narrative about what life is supposed to be like, what I was supposed to give her. You know, it had been a relationship I had very little role in because it wasn't anything I did, and that therefore I could change it was who I was, what I looked like, and what she expected me to be, which was in some sense the miracle of her completion and happiness. She was very convinced that I was a tremendously powerful person who could give her something that would make her whole in some way, that if I loved her properly, adored her enough, was uncritical enough, then she would be okay, and she wasn't okay, and it was all my fault, you know, which is in, well, to put it in really succinct modern terms, which sucks, you know, particularly because, you know, it had nothing to do with what I did, and what she wanted from me, you know, was impossible, and it's a thing people often want from someone else that's not someone else's to give you. And then she forgot, and it was also really interesting because it was about living in the present. Suddenly I showed up. I was this person she liked who was there to help her, who was nice to her, and that was enough. And, you know, and it wasn't just that life got easier for me. I think it did for her. She wasn't tormented by her narratives. They weren't just about me, but about, you know, which child her mother loved best and what was difficult in her childhood and what hadn't turned out in her life. All the stories were gone. And she took pleasure in what there was to take pleasure in, that a walk was a pleasurable thing. Flowers were, you know, every flower was the most beautiful flower. Every piece of cake was the most delicious piece of cake. And it was a kind of living in the present that people strive for through spiritual practice that came a very different way. But that was quite remarkable and really something I learned from, just this enormous pleasure in the moment, unattached to narratives about what came before, what would come after.
And now tell us about the apricots.
The book was really launched by what in the book I describe as 100 pounds of apricots. I was trying to be reasonable in my estimate for the book launch in San Francisco, which happened in June during apricot season. I went out and bought from one of my farmers' markets 100 pounds of apricots and realized that had been far more than that, that my younger brother brought me from the tree in the backyard of the house my mother would never live in again the summer that things started to go seriously wrong. He, as part of his caregiving and anxiety, decided that he needed to pick every apricot on her tree, the unripe ones, the overripe ones, etc. He brought the lion's share to me, and they just seemed so fantastic, this overabundance, this sort of avalanche of fruit in my apartment in San Francisco, and what was I going to do with them? And they felt like fairy tale material, both in the sense of the mysterious birthright, the talking horse, the talking bird, or the five magic beans, or the key to an unknown door, word of power. There's something very powerful about them. And my mother had been very eager to not give me things, and suddenly here was this lavish gift from her in a way. But they also felt like the fairy tale task, the ridiculously over-the-top work you have to do to weave, you know, to spin a whole room full of straw into gold overnight on pain of death, the glass mountain you have to climb, or the mountain of mixed grains you have to separate out into barley and wheat and rice overnight. And what was I going to do with 100 pounds? You know, actually, I think it was my own body weight in apricots. And they sat there on my bedroom floor. I'd unpack them from the box as they came in to try and slow down their crushing and decaying. And they were decaying. And so I had to deal with the physical apricots. I canned and gave them away and did other things with, and baked and did other things with them. But they were also, what was my birthright? What had my mother given me? What was I going to do with it? You know, they were also metaphysical. And they also felt like an allegory. And the allegory itself continued to change. A year later, it felt like they had been kind of a model of my life at that moment. What was sweet and worth preserving? What was rotten or bad and needed to be excised? And, you know, so that was the work I was there to do, was to, you know, deal physically with these physical apricots, but deal more metaphysically with what they meant, what they're an allegory for, what that, what kind of an allegory, what story could be told. And in a way, this whole book, you know, all 60,000 words or so can be imagined as, you know, an answer to the question of what these apricots were.
And the book is The Faraway Nearby, and we're talking with the author, Rebecca Solnit, talking about something to be excised. You found out at a certain point here that you had a cancer scare. You wrote to your friends at the time as you were going into treatment that you were going to be cured of more than you had been diagnosed with. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I had, you know, cancer light or anomalies that might lead to cancer that required surgery. So, but there was also the, you know, undergoing major medical intervention reminds you of your mortality, challenges you to figure out where you're wasting your time, what's important. For me, I had been somebody who'd, of whom much had been demanded, who had also been trained to not ask for much. I'd been very self-sufficient. I'd been kind of unstoppable and superhuman. I had to tell people, you know, I was actually writing another book, my book, A Paradise Built in Hell, which is about more public disaster and community. I had to tell my editors I wasn't going to finish on time. I had to ask people for help. I had to look at my own mortality and think about, you know, what, and it wasn't like, oh, I was leading a terrible life and everything needed to change, but it was really just more subtle emphases and values, what was important, who was there for me, what I wanted to do. You know, and I think this happens with both public catastrophe, as I learned writing A Paradise Built in Hell, and the private disaster that can be a breakup or a death in the family or of someone close to you or an illness, where it was a wake-up call, which is kind of a cliche, you know. But if you think about it literally, you know, suddenly you're awake to who am I, what do I want to do with the rest of my life, given how fleeting the time may be, what really matters, who can I trust, what do I value, and what have I been wasting my time on? And I think that, you know, many kinds of upheaval in our lives brings that on. And it can be really salutary. It's like not that illness or disaster or divorce or death are good things, but you realize you've been adrift in some way or not doing what matters most or means most, and you adjust your course.
And you also use these chapters in which you talk about this confrontation with your mortality to contemplate. And here, I don't think we've talked about this before, but much of your book is an interweaving of many different layers of stories of history, natural science, commentary, along with your memoir. So you talk about in these chapters about Che Guevara, lepers, and the development of compassion. Weave those together for us, at least briefly here.
I'm somebody who's literally been making maps in some of my other recent books, and I've decided that all over the map is a virtue and not a vice. But the book goes many places with the stories that came to me, like Charlie Musselwhite's story, during this period that I found really helpful to think deeply about empathy and compassion, about how we connect. Something that doesn't get said much is that empathy isn't just an emotional quality or a virtue, but it's really a storytelling art. How do I understand your suffering so that I can realize it in my own head and heart, so that I can respond to it? I listen to your story. I learn to tell your story. I imagine what it's like to be you. It's really an imaginative art. It's a narrative art of sorts. And so, you know, and a lot of stories came to me that were quite remarkable of different people dealing with these things in different ways. And one that I found so compelling was of Che Guevara during the pivotal period of his life, where he left what could have been a very conventional future of being a doctor in Buenos Aires from a fairly privileged family, maybe a society, becoming a society doctor, and became instead a revolutionary. The movie The Motorcycle Diaries and the book have both become quite well known, and they're often seen as this very Jack Kerouac on the road, young man's adventure. And what's played down in the interpretations that are most common, I think, is that he and his companion, the wonderful Alberto Granado, were not just wandering around South America on a motorcycle. They were going from leprosarium to leper colony. Granado was already a specialist in leprosy. Che was considering a future focusing on that disease and attracted them partly because it was the disease of outcasts, the people most rejected and exiled from society. And, you know, these were the people for whom there was the least empathy, the least welcome, the least compassion. So it was kind of radical to identify with these people, to care for them, to find common cause with them in a way. But leprosy itself, as I found out from the man I was in the middle of a breakup with, is, you know, in the course of the most turbulent part of the events I narrate in this book, the disease of leprosy is a remarkable thing in itself that became another allegory. People often thought and still think that, you know, your fingers and toes fall off, you just kind of rot away. But that isn't really it. Although leprosy is a bacteria, it damages your nerves and you lose your feelings. Literally, you can no longer feel your fingers or your toes or your hands and feet. And what you can't feel, you can't take care of. And that was such an extraordinary metaphor for how we deal with each other. You know, when you care about somebody, it's as though the boundaries of yourself extend into them. You care so deeply, particularly about a child or the person you're in love with, the people you live with, you know, maybe just a friend or somebody you might care about on the other side of the world, you know, the very ill Nelson Mandela, perhaps. Or, you know, concomitantly, you don't care about the child you or the wife you beat, the person you ignore or refuse to understand or listen to, do terrible things to. You know, how? Where do our boundaries extend and where do they shrink? Often we don't even hear ourselves. I've seen people suffer terribly because they refuse to acknowledge that what they're doing doesn't work, that they are suffering, that, you know, that things are going terribly wrong. And leprosy became such an interesting way to think about how terrible numbness is, which I think is very counter to how we talk about it often in our culture, which thinks pain is the problem and that our great goal is to avoid feeling pain. And often avoiding feeling pain, as with people with leprosy, is avoiding feeling that something's wrong so that you can address it and it gets worse. People with leprosy, you know, they can't feel their hands. They hold a cigarette until it burns a hole in their fingers. and then they don't take care of the wound, and the wound becomes infected, and you can see, you know, the same thing can happen to your feet. We're constantly making adjustments to accommodate the little discomforts we feel before they become injuries. But what you don't feel, you can injure so easily. You know, you can even kill, whether it's another person or your own awareness, your own sensitivity, or some part of your body. So that's how Che Guevara became part of a book that I describe as an anti-memoir as much as a memoir. Anti-memoir because it's not just about myself. It's not the linear narrative just about the self that we've learned to tell as memoir or as the story you tell a therapist. It's much broader than that, very full of other people.
It's a beautiful book, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us, Rebecca Solnit. The book is The Faraway Nearby. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for such thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it.
Rebecca Solnit. You can read an excerpt from The Faraway Nearby by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, poet Martine Bellin. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Reading the poetry of Martine Bellin is an excursion into a fascinating labyrinth of language that evokes multiple meanings. Her work is more to be experienced with the heart and soul than dissected with the mind. Her latest poetry collection is The Wayback Machine. The title references both the Rocky and Bullwinkle show, as well as the past iterations of the internet. Fellow poet Charles North wrote, "Martine Bellin's psychological and linguistic adventures in poetry are unlike anyone else's. Celebrating the instabilities of our experience, her poems maneuver kaleidoscopically between ordinary life and myth or fairy tale, vital human concerns such as identity, and dreamlike atmospheres where nothing stays as it appears for long." Martine Bellin is the author of 8 collections of poetry, including Tales of Murasaki and Other Poems, which won the National Poetry Series Award, as well as the novella Two Times Squared and several librettos for opera. Bellin is a contributing editor of the literary journal Conjunctions. Martine Bellin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, your poetry volume, is it pronounced Wayback Machine?
Yes, Wayback Machine. It comes from Mr. Peabody's improbable history from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. And Mr. Peabody would take Sherman into the Wayback Machine, the time machine. And time and space are two of the aspects that I explore in the collection.
Those are themes that run through, and also memory.
Yes, memory also, and identity, and how one defines oneself, and the numerous identities that lives in each of us. The first poem, Customers Who Have Bought Sleeping Beauty Have Also Bought This, starts with a dictionary. And then one of the last poems, Metropolis, ends with a dictionary.
And actually, I'd like to get right to it and ask you to read this first page of Customers Who Have Bought Sleeping Beauty Have Also Bought This.
So often the pieces are longer than one might expect for poetry. I'll read the first page. So it starts with a dictionary, a definition of me, capital M-E, and it's a pronoun and the objective case of I, and then there are 5 definitions. 1, a state in New England. 2, me, a concept in the cosmology of Sumerian mythology. 3, net energy available in certain foods. 4, a think group that resides in my head. A large furry animal, a me, the me. And 5, a bullet's point of entry. Upon awakening from a story, before walking through the portal to the hallway into a land where language is required, I confirm I'm me, (a state in New England, and a think group, end parentheses. Some days I don't arrive at the threshold of my body, and a deep, cavernous loss resides where me would have been. The cave paintings in Lascaux, horses, bulls, and stags, motifs that repeat when I can't see where I'm headed, when I'm in a forest. Some days I ingest donuts and sourdough. Some days I sleep deep in mud, like a fish that wants to stop drifting, day into night into day.
I love this. And I'm going to ask you first to just explain some of the definitions, because I've never heard of them before. And I'm not going to so much ask you to explain the poem per se, but just these, me, a concept in the cosmology of Sumerian mythology?
Well, in this poem or story, I'm working with fairy tales. A number of pieces in the book, I use fairy tales or fairy tale motifs because of their cross-cultural expansion. And I also, you know, have referred to Jung in some of the poems, and the idea of the archetype is important to me. So mythology and how different cultures throughout time and expanse connect to one another. So what I'm working with too also is the idea of the truth, and the truth as we know it in volumes such as the dictionary, which is, of course, a fluctuating, always changing truth. So I'm playing with that a little bit, and also the sense of the me and the identity of who I am. So these most of these aren't really me. I mean, me is I, which we all, and also me is a state in New England. But other than that, there is no me is not those things. But it's interesting, you know, when you think about that, like, for instance, something that I was working with in this particular poem is I'm interested in Chinese and Japanese culture and language. And so one of the things that interests me, I was studying Shodo Japanese calligraphy, and it interests me how a specific word has very different meanings in different contexts. In English, this is less so. I mean, probably it is a little bit in ways that I'm not necessarily conscious. But I know in Japanese and Chinese, the use of a word, for instance, koi, fish, is a fish. And it also means something like, come here, you know. So words, you'll have, let's say, the word for sky, or I think it's emptiness, and sky are the same word that you'll see, let's say, in a parking lot that's empty. And so having to define the word through the context becomes very important. And so that's something else that I'm playing around with in this particular poem. And in the poem, The Memory Group, as you had mentioned, memory is something that is also very interesting to me, something I think a lot about as my memory gets worse and worse, especially. And my grandmother had Alzheimer's, so it's a fear and something that I'm very, very conscious about. And, you know, also, as you know, as I see people and generations pass away and die, the draining of memory is something I find very important, you know, something that I'm very aware of. And so in this particular poem, I have this one line, the ability to choose the correct meaning of an action appropriate to a particular social situation. And that is important in terms of the soundness of one's mind, but also in terms of just living with a language where meanings are so various that that's just a, you know, a regular occurrence. So those are some of the ideas that I was playing with in terms of having the dictionary and having false or untrue, perhaps untrue, definitions of me, because maybe I am the net energy of certain foods. You know, I mean, I am energy. I am that too. And I am a large furry animal also. So these aren't not me. I am also a think group. I'm a very, very big think group that resides in my head. So it's not like I'm not these things. I am these things, but they probably aren't the definition that one would see in a dictionary.
And a bullet's point of entry.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about the way that we penetrate life and also the violence in our lives. And so that definition is so different than the other definitions. And I was looking for something that was so different because, again, you know, thinking about languages where the definitions vary so much, I was looking for a definition that really, you know, had a certain amount of violence and a certain amount of penetration in it. So, yeah.
And also it seems that a poem was almost a bullet's point of entry.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that, but it's true. I mean, the poem itself is that. It's trying to enter. I mean, my work is what I would call experiential. I think that when a reader is reading it or listening to it, rather than mastering it and understanding, you know, feeling as though, okay, I can write, let's say, a thesis on this, that hopefully the poem will find its way into the reader and there'll be this relationship of embodiment. But I do want to connect to people with my work. I want that to be the connection. So that would be, I guess, the bullet entering into the listener or the reader. And so, yeah.
In these poems, they had, in a way, the nature of what I imagine a Zen koan is, in the sense that they're meant to disrupt the hyper left brain intellectual processes. Am I right about that?
Yes, yes, definitely. Or at least I feel as though some of the questions that arise through Zen, and when I say through Zen, I mean not only on the cushion, but then off of the cushion in life, are questions that I'm exploring in this work. There's one poem, Snowing Oven. I felt as though that poem came out of a little bit of a different impulse for me that felt very much like koan work, and which was really fun.
And first, tell our listeners, what is a koan?
Well, a koan is a story word puzzle mostly in a Renzai practice, but also sometimes in Soto, you'll have it where the sitter will sit with this koan, and a very well-known koan is what is the sound of one hand clapping. It's really the koan is just with one hand, not with the clapping, but in this country we tend to say clapping. And so then you sit with this question or these words that are impossible to answer, and you can't answer them with your logical mind. It's the opposite of your analytical mind. For many Americans, that's difficult because many of us think of our mind as our brain. And so to start thinking about the mind as something else, to think about the mind in connection with the body and the heart and the being is I think a little bit of a challenge for some people. For me, definitely, the idea of getting away from the brain and figuring things out. And that's a big part of what the koan is, to break free from figuring it out. But at the same time, that all the answers are there, that we, you know, that each of us have all the answers. And that's also an interesting idea for a society, for a world that emphasizes going outside of the self for teachings, to say, okay, well, we all have what we need. We all have the teachings inside of ourselves if we sit with them and look for them and be with them. So that's Koan. So I'll read this then. So the poem's title is Snowing Oven. And I wrote this poem, a poet, Joanna Furman, who is an editor for a journal in Big Sur called Ping Pong, asked a group of people if they would be interested in writing poems that are based on a poem called What Is That? By the sculptor artist Jean Arp. And so this poem, What Is That? Is a series of questions. So I read, the poem, and there were these two lines of the poem that really resonated with me. There is nothing but snow in that white hot stove. And so I worked with that almost as a koan, it felt like, when I was working with it. And so this is what came up. When you open your smiling oven, steaming noodles and goodies, some snow leopards sleep on the mount of my tongue. So adept in hiding are they that I barely know when they're there, though sometimes a purr melting through me, preheat. Open wide. There is nothing in your mouth, just a wintry mix, groomed trails, slopes, more snow squalls, more drifts. I get it. You wouldn't say what was in the oven, your mouth closed for the weather, for winter. Snow spices, pickens. After all, melting is not the same as disappearing. Your open smile, heat. If I drill through your snow to the hidden lake region, baking ancient snow, swirling frosting, icing. It's snowing, nothing to do but bake, always so tempting to open a warm, fresh smile.
Yes, and I see exactly what you mean. It's like I thoroughly enjoy that. I can't explain it in any, you know, like this means this or this means that, but I feel like I know it.
Right. Yeah, that is what I'm, you know, what I'm hoping for is for someone to feel comfortable with my work. Also, I use a lot of humor. I mean, I do address questions that I think of as very important, so that there is a certain gravitas in some of the work. But at the same time, I like there to be humor. And I also like for the language to lead to the next word so that I feel as though I'm in a relationship with the language that I'm writing and I'm not always guiding it. I'm actually, it's usually guiding me. And it's showing me the next step of where to go. And that often starts with the sounds of the words.
And a book that is titled in reference to something in Rocky and Bullwinkle can't be completely serious.
Exactly right. And also, I mean, some of the work in the third section of the book, I have some work that addresses anime and manga. And so I work with cartoons also. I'm interested in cartoons because you know one of the themes in the book has to do with you know, reality and you know and questioning what is reality. And I find that, you know, anime and cartoons allow for reality to bend in on itself and expand out from itself. And, you know, so in, you know, in cartoons, of course, you know, somebody will jump from, you know, be pushed off a rock and they'll get smashed and then they'll walk off. And so there's this other whole reality. In fact, even in anime, you'll have a lot of characters will have, you know, purple hair and round eyes. And so, you know, even though it's Japanese, the race is its own race. It's the anime race. And so I think it's interesting how we all understand this other kind of reality and accept it.
And we're talking with Martine Bellin about her new poetry volume. It's called Wayback Machine. I wondered if you could also read, this is another part of the first poem that you spoke about. Customers who have bought Sleeping Beauty have also bought this. It's very short, just a paragraph. And I think it encompasses that thinking about deep subjects in a way that enchants and delights.
Thank you for saying that. Okay, so this is part of the same poem, which is customers who have bought Sleeping Beauty have also bought this. And that, of course, refers back to the Amazon. In Amazon, when you buy something, it always gives you suggestions to buy something else, depending on the type of person that you seem to be from what you've bought before. So, she rushes through an hour like a hallway. The alarm rings as she attempts to outrun the wolf, the wind, music imprisoned by its bars, the breath of bars and their throbbing beer-soaked walls. Flesh and time swap outfits. Either way, a jailer enforces a life sentence. Either way, we wither.
And so, do you remember the impetus for this poem?
This poem, I was working mostly with various fairy tale motifs and the idea of death. That's something that always... I mean, that's just one of the questions that I think everybody has, right? I mean, and death is so much a part of fairy tales. and cartoons.
And kind of the question, will I still be me when I die?
Right, exactly. So in this particular section, again, I'm playing a lot with words and how close they are to one another. So when you look at even a character like the wolf in a fairy tale, what happens if the wolf was the wind? You know, what happens when you just kind of change the composition of one character to another character, an animate to an inanimate to an animate? And where does that leave us? And then also, of course, looking at the idea of the sentence that we read, because this is I think of it as a poem, it's a prose poem. And a lot of my work is in the, not all of it, but much, I use the sentence a lot. So yeah, the life sentence.
And talking about fairy tales, I mean, there's the Hansel and Gretel poem. There are a number of them. I love this one too, if you wouldn't mind just reading that, which is part of the poem called The Gossamer Tincture.
Yeah, I use Hansel and Gretel a lot in this poem. And I also, I'm working a lot with the idea of losing things. In this poem, the main character loses objects. She loses identity. She is a bride. She's like loses being a bride. But the one thing that she seems to keep throughout is her twin brother. And twins, that's always something that's interested me. I guess that idea of the other, the doppelganger, you know, the deep connection that maybe we have with each other, but some special connection also. So this is a section from this piece. She used to be the sister and wandered directionless in the broad forest with her lost brother. If she hadn't lost her wits, she'd be witch fodder like that twin. I dedicated this poem to the poet Melinda Markham. I actually... Melinda Markham committed suicide, and she is an amazing poet. She wrote two books, 95 Nights of Listening and Having Cut the Sparrow's Heart. And she's an incredible poet. She was I know she was younger than I am. And she recently committed suicide. And I started writing this poem before that happened, but... I felt like after I finished the poem, there was so much in it that kind of reminded me of her. Her poems have a lot of fairy tale work in it. And both she and I have issues of getting lost. I can get lost anywhere. I'm always so pleased with myself when I don't get lost. And I always find getting anywhere an adventure. And I think she had even more problem with getting lost than I do. But so I started looking at the poem and it had so many parts of it reminded me of her. And so I wanted to offer it to her.
Do you want to read another part?
Yeah, I'll read. I like this part. Okay. So again, in the story, this is very much of a more of a narrative than some of my pieces, where you really do have this one young bride. I think she's mostly identified as a bride, and her world seems to be falling apart, falling away from her. So here she says, she knew her husband lived a secret, ponderous, separate life from his meanderings in the small thatched cottage they shared together. In a dream, she combed through his pockets and found a map of his daily travels. There on the east side of the map, near where the sun rose, was their life together, while up above into the west were multitudinous kingdoms rich with tapestries of eels and unicorns, firstborns, mint gardens, mine gardens, and fair maidens haunting deep wells, showered as she was with small trinkets and favors and magical words. Jealousy is yellow, drinking calms it. She poured herself into the glass. Many cracks defaced her vista. There was the earth with its small fissures, the sky with light chips cracking through, and the mirror that exaggerated the cracks around her eyes. There was the fractured ocean crashing and cracking at the seams with tornadoes of light, and also a heaviness she could not name.
It's so visual. I could just picture the whole thing as you were reading.
Yeah, I do work with a lot of imagery, and you know, and again, I counter that also with the sounds of the words, and I kind of explore that, the connection between sound and picture. Yeah.
Could you say a little more about that?
Well, okay. For instance, there's a poem that, "The Secret Conversing of Birds." I'm working with the 13th century Persian poet Rumi and also Farid ud-Din Attar, the 12th century poet who wrote "The Conference of the Birds." But mostly what I'm working with is the way that movement and sound and poetry can dance together. And so the images are hopefully very vivid, but at the same time, the sound itself is constantly dancing and circling. And so I'm thinking about whirling dervishes and what home means. And so home, which is a, I think, a very interesting sounding word in that it's so open, home. It's really almost like a breath. It's almost like om. So that's very much the foundation and center of this work. And at the same time, the images, many of them bird images, are holding on to that sound basically, so that it's not just sound, but there's the dancing images. So I can read that if, yeah, okay. So "The Secret Conversing of Birds." Sometimes it starts with a murder of crows congregating on an echoing field of Persian onions in bloom, wild leeks, crimson poppy. Caw, caw. The crow circles its cry, never returning to the taking place, the spin-off point, as if Dr. Maximus of Theosophical Speculation, donned in body's negative dervish frock, swims the earth's solid breath. Coo, coo, where, where? Is he listening to melodic hammering at the goldsmith's smithy, dancing for hours, never turning twice, as if the good doctor were exiled in the flesh of Rumi, where illuminations join at the interior and anterior edge, where everything is the same, only somehow something is not. His feminine tears submerge the bolted landscape as they mutually dissolve. With loss of motion goes memory. With collapsed space, our dervish halts, uttering, utterly, alone, uttering to strings of light. Coo, coo, he says. Coo, coo, they reply, into the shelter of thought that forms a hapless desire for a deep, divine homelessness, as if homelessing amounts to attaining or being initiated into the inspirited inspirialis, as if buildings abruptly refuse to conceal their exhausting dance, as we follow our homes into our lives, as if our lives depend on our seeking or seeing, scrying tears where poeming commences, as if the ancient dances of homing and whirling were distinct, as we circle our cries to call ourselves home.
And Martine Bellin continues reading her poem, "The Secret Conversing of Birds," online, because, alas, we have run out of time for today's show. There's also much more to our conversation at writersvoice.net. Visit the website to hear the rest. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.